refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. So we've come to cash this check,
yes.
A check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom, yes. And the security of justice. Yes.
Welcome to another episode of Black and White and Thin Blue Lines. My name is Clark Ollers.
And I'm Serge Antonin.
And we have two topics today. Our first topic involves the tragic passing, the murder of a New York City police officer that's been in the news. His name, God rest his soul, was Jonathan Diller. He was 31 years old, married, a father. And on March 25th, 2024, at about 6 p.m., he was working a detail in Far Rockaway, Queens, New York, came upon a vehicle that was parked in a bus stop. Hardly an incident that you'd even be on full alert and fearful of approaching the vehicle. In any event, he approached the vehicle. He was getting a person out of the car when he was shot. The bullet entered under his vest. Into his midsection, and he died. There's some very graphic videos on the internet of him screaming and so forth. He was in terrible pain. I will say this, in a way, he's my hero for one reason. He wrestled the gun from the shooter prior to his passing to protect his fellow officers,
who then opened fire on the suspect, who was injured but not killed.
His name, the suspect, is Guy Rivera, 21 prior arrests. And Serge, this is in the news for all sorts of reasons. Why don't you give our listeners your first reaction?
Well, it's in the news because once again, Mayor Eric Adams has renewed his calls to Albany for them to address criminal recidivism. And both suspects were ex-cons. So, you know, who were armed with guns. They were both to have been found in possession of guns. They weren't both fired. Only Rivera's gun was fired. But the driver of the vehicle, a man by the name of Lindy Jones, was also armed. So he was arrested. And it's also in the news because this year, we're in 2024, is on pace to set a record for officers shot in the line of duty. The National Fraternal Order of Police said 2023 set a record for officers shot in the line of duty. And new numbers show that this year could surpass that, Clark Ollers, which to me is, I don't know, but I kind of saw this coming. And so far this year, 10 officers have died while serving and 98 have been shot. And here we are in the beginning of April of 2024, and away we go. And in 2023, 46 officers were killed while a record 378 were shot. So it just doesn't – it's a sad commentary, Clark Ollers.
I think it is a sad commentary, and there are a couple of subtopics here that are important to consider about police officer deaths, but police officers shot in the line of duty. The first is whether there's a correlation between there were various movements. One was Black Lives Matter. Others were defund the police. They, in my opinion, they kind of merged, meaning that there were advocates or activists, might be a better word, in those political groups that were strongly urging defunding of the police, which did take place. But to me, the bigger issue isn't just the dollars and cents that did or did not get allocated for law enforcement. I personally believe you might be hard pressed to prove that the limited allocation of funds is directly related to the increase in violence against police. What I think is there is a correlation. I'm not saying I can prove it, but I think there's a correlation between the contempt for the police that was implicit in both Black Lives Matter and defund the police. I think that contempt for the police is correlated to the increase in violence against the police.
Well, I partially agree with that, but I'm willing to say that the contempt for police from within the police organizations has a more direct correlation to the violence against the police. And here's what I mean. We discussed how Anthony Batts in Baltimore told his officers to stand down during the Freddie Gray riots. And I think that sentiment has been kind of echoed throughout the policing landscape in this country. So when the police stand down, the criminals stand up, and it creates a further contempt. When they know the police are on their heels, it's just like in a fight. When you know you've got your adversary on their heels, you don't back up, you press forward. And I believe that that's what we're witnessing now. And regardless of how you feel about the police, because we're not super pro cop, we're case by case guys who believe that there are some bad police and some very, or many very honorable ones. We've discussed it on this podcast. But at the end of the day, our goal is to be safe. So if armed men and women in uniform aren't safe from these ne'er-do-wells with guns, Glock switches, and the like, then we certainly aren't any more safe, Clark Ellers.
Serge, I think that your point about the, in effect, the heads of law enforcement agencies ordering police officers or directing police officers to stand down, I actually think that's a completely valid point. I personally believe that point is the result of the politics of Black Lives Matter and defund the police. And I think that most police chiefs and police commissioners and superintendents of police are first and foremost politicians. Secondly, they're bureaucrats. Thirdly, they're cops. So cops are the last thing on their mind when they – and I do think they tell – I've long believed
– Can I add a fourth?
Sure.
They're narcissists.
Some probably are. I don't know that we can go across the board on that, but
– I'm crossing the board, Clark Ellers.
Well, the – but there's no question in my mind that in many jurisdictions, I don't care about their public display of weeping after the police officer shot.
And their families certainly do not, the families of these officers.
I strongly believe that in most jurisdictions, they're indifferent to police officers being hurt in the line of duty. And the reason I say that, that's a very harsh thing to say. It's a harsh criticism of many police managers across the country. But the reason I say it is, if they cared, the policies would be protecting police officers, and they would be advocating for the policies that protect police officers. They wouldn't be championing, for example, a no-choke policy and a no-this policy and a no-that policy.
And how about this, Clark Ellers? How about they broadcast the statistics of police officers injured in the line of duty? Not just shot, but injured from assaults. Not just car wrecks, but assaults, whether they're shootings, punches to the face, kicks to the groin, because these things are definitely documented when force is used. So why don't they broadcast those stats?
You know, Serge, I'm just going to throw this out for our listeners to think about sometime if you happen to be on a jury or you happen to have a role in policy. But all of these police chiefs, to a person, talk about how they stand on the side of the officer and they want the officer to be safe and they care so much. And every one of these jurisdictions fights the workers' comp claims.
Everyone.
Right. And so, to me, put your money where your mouth is. Really, you care so much about these police, you're so concerned about them. When they're injured in the line of duty and their doctor says they have a 15% disability, I guarantee you're filing something saying they have a 0% disability and you compromise at 7.5%, and that's because it's money. And you're much more concerned about your budget than you are the safety of the officers.
And the security of their salaries.
One of the things that I find so interesting about the I'm going to call it a dichotomy in law enforcement between the line officers and the brass is this. I personally believe there's no safer job in America than being a police supervisor working in a station because, and the public should be aware of this, they're armed all day. You don't get into their office without passing through a metal detector. They're typically surrounded by other units that are armed. They have a radio that alerts them to all trouble. They have armed people that are sworn to take action to protect them at the desk before you even enter the building. In other words, they're in one of the safest little environments. They are safer than I am sitting in my law office.
They're in a bubble.
Right. They're absolutely in a bubble. And yet, when a police officer gets hurt, they're the first ones to say, every morning we get up, put this uniform on and kiss our family goodbye, and we don't know whether we're going to see him that night. Really? Really? Because I would give you a life insurance policy. In other words, of course you're going to see your family that night unless you die of obesity from all the donuts you've eaten because they're safe.
Yep.
And what is dangerous? This cop, young Officer Diller, getting out of his car in Far Rockaway and approaching felons who are on the street, as most felons are in America.
And one of the things we've often discussed on this podcast is the fact that the crime may be minute, but these guys are willing to, you don't know who you're coming up upon, and these guys are willing to hurt you to get away.
Serge, I got to tell you, I'm being candid and trying to remember what I was like as a police officer, and I don't think I'd be that different today.
Mm-hmm.
I would not have been on high alert approaching a car parked in a buzz zone. In other words,
a bus zone.
Bus zone,
yeah.
If I said it wrong.
No, that's fine.
But you and I both know 90% of the time you're going to meet a driver who's going to say, I'm just waiting for my wife. I just dropped this. And everybody has an excuse. By the way, the excuse is practical. New York, it's very hard to pick people up and drop them off in traffic.
I was just in New York, and let me tell you, I parked in quite a few bus zones for a second while I was trying to find parking.
Correct.
So you're absolutely right.
Letting people out and picking them up and so forth.
Absolutely.
Of course. So I'm sure that I don't know what Officer Diller was thinking. I don't know why he was getting the man out of the vehicle. Now, this became...
Well, he's assigned to this Queens Community Response Team, so we also don't know what he knows.
Correct.
About the crime trends and what goes on.
Very valid point.
Just he's assigned there as one of his duties is quality of life crimes, like
right.
Some guy sitting in the bus stop, you know, you're blocking... People need to take public transportation, so you're blocking the bus stop. So that's a hindrance.
You know, the other thing which is, which you almost can't over, almost just can't exaggerate is the poor judgment of the criminal element in the United States of America. They're willing to kill a police officer over what would have been If the person had been arrested, it would have been 5 years in prison or 10 years in prison if the police officer had the right to search him and take a gun off him.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure the police officer even had the right to search this guy. New York doesn't have the stop and frisk the way they used to have it.
Yes.
So statistically, Mr. Rivera was unlikely to have been frisked, even if he got out of the car at the direction of the police officer. But he took it upon himself to commit a horrible crime.
Well, you got to consider the fact that he had 21 prior arrests.
Oh, and I get that.
My point is that doesn't speak to him having a high IQ or great impulse control. So
no, it does not. Although I might say that, like I said in Freddie Gray, if there was one guy who should have been able to be in the back of a police paddy wagon and make it safely to the station, it was Freddie Gray because he'd done it many, many times before.
Mm-hmm.
This guy probably knows the cops are 90% of the time not going to frisk you when they get you out of the car.
Yeah.
In this day and age in New York because of all the hostility about frisks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What race was the suspect, you know?
Well, the last name is a
Hispanic,
Hispanic surname, but he appeared to be a brown skin male, okay. So of some
and
African.
Diller appeared to be white on the news.
Descent. Yes.
I'll tell you, the next interesting aspects of this case are that on the same day as his either viewing or funeral. The Democrats, President Clinton, President Biden, and President Obama, and obviously two are former presidents, but the three presidents had a fundraiser in New York that raised over $25 million for Biden's reelection campaign. Trump, who ordinarily is, his comments tend to be self-centered, Trump, in my opinion, had the good judgment to honor the police officer, speak to the officer's family, and when he made his remarks after leaving the funeral home, he was actually very, very, he was political, but he didn't make it about him.
I don't know if that had anything to do with his judgment, but he's always been pro-cop. So to me—
Right, but what I mean is he didn't come out, what I thought he was going to say, here's what I predicted. He was going to come out and say, Alvin Bragg's prosecuting me, you know, and meantime— Guy Rivera's out there with a gun.
I thought he'd say that,
but he didn't. He actually, his remarks, I thought, were appropriate.
More thoughtful?
Thoughtful and appropriate.
Okay. Right.
Now,
I can buy that.
Governor Hochul arrives at the funeral home. Kathy Hochul, the New York governor, who Eric Adams, by the way, Eric Adams, I think you're right. He had, I know you're right, where he has said Albany's got to do something about recidivism. He's also said Albany's got to do something about the bail policy in New York, which is everybody gets let out. You have, you're accused of a gun, you're let out to your trial date, and you get arrested with another gun, you're let out to your trial date for the second. I'm being serious, Serge. It's ludicrous, and the cops know it's ludicrous.
Oh, it's ludicrous.
So Kathy Hochul arrives, and she is unwelcome. She is asked to leave.
Confront. Well, I was reading something, and you don't actually hear what the gentleman's saying, but she claims she wasn't actually asked to leave. But she respectfully left. I personally think she was, if she wasn't overtly asked to leave, she was, it was implied. Maybe you should get out of here, lady.
Here's what I think her statement meant.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the man said to her, and I don't, I have, I'm speculating. I'm telling our listeners, I don't know what was said. I speculate that he said, you're not welcome here. Now, agreed, that doesn't mean she's told to leave, so she can say, oh, I wasn't asked to leave. Right. But let me put it this way. In my entire life, and I've gone to lots of funeral homes, I've never left without going in and paying my respects to the family.
Especially if that was your intention.
Correct.
To come and pay your respects.
Of course. So she left without paying her respects, and she had state troopers guarding her. And I'd love to have been a fly in the, you know, on the
those car seats.
Oh, my God. Listening to that back and forth as she drove away from there.
Yes.
But let me tell you, Serge, I love the fact that whoever was there invited her not to enter or whatever. However they did it, they did it. Why? Because I think she was there as a political stunt. She has done nothing for the safety of police officers in New York. I feel like she's another one of these governors who lies and says, crime is down, crime is down, crime is down. Everything's working. It's nonsense. Her latest move, of course, was to put the New York National Guard in the New York City subway system with M4s. And then to take the M4s away from them because she said it looked too militaristic. Well, again, here we are.
Standing there with first aid kits.
Better you get pushed in front of a subway car than we look like. There's a lot of crime in the subway.
Absolutely.
Because you are, you, every one of our listeners is expendable to the government, in my mind.
Yes, they are.
Serge, any more comments on God rest his soul, but the passing of Jonathan Diller?
Well, I just hope that this, well, when you consider the fact that the ranks are down countrywide, the ranks are down, and the government continues to pretend that crime is trending down, while it's not, obviously. It's sad for me to say this, but I don't think that this will be the last police killing that we're going to see, last police assault, last shooting of a police officer. And like I said earlier, the byproduct of that is you and I and people like us are going to be less safe. So I just hope that some lessons are learned and something is done.
I want to invite our listeners to look at people's actions rather than their words. if crime is down, I would ask all of the politicians that are telling us this crime is down, do you now leave your doors unlocked in a way that you didn't in the past? You locked them, but since crime is down, you've fallen into the habit of leaving unlocked. Have your insurance rates gone down? Right?
Absolutely.
Right, right. In other words,
I never even thought of it that way.
Well, but I think, you know, I always look at these, you know.
Yeah.
When I get my insurance bill this year, it went up.
Money where your mouth is.
Well, right. It went up. And I wonder why it went up. It went up because the insurance companies know cars are being stolen at an ever-increasing rate. And what is the crime? In fact, Tom Mariello, who invited us to speak at his class this week, mm-hmm. What did Tom Mariello add to his CSI checklist?
Carjackings.
Right, because the police said, we get a lot of carjackings now.
Mm-hmm.
In my entire 14 years on the Howard County Police Department, I don't believe I handled a single carjacking. And in other words, it is harder now to steal a car physically.
Yes.
They've improved security. So the criminals just wait till you're behind the wheel with the key in the ignition, steal it directly from you with a gun in your ear.
No longer can you use a screwdriver or a butter knife.
Use a 9mm.
Now you
got to
have the key. Exactly.
You know, with a Glock switch.
Yes.
You'll be all right.
Now you got to actually have the key fob.
Right.
And then the next thing
I want to ask is, since particularly all these Democrat mayors of cities that are telling us everywhere from Chicago to New Orleans to Baltimore that crime is down – have you, since crime is down, this is what I would ask the mayor of Baltimore, Brandon Scott. And he says crime is down in Baltimore, correct, Serge?
Of course.
Okay. So I would say, Mayor, call on me. I'm the news person at
yeah.
the news conference. Mayor, since crime is down, and also since Baltimore City is understaffed with police officers, have you taken those officers that were on your security detail and sent them back to patrol? Because you don't need them anymore. Crime is down in the city, Mr. Mayor.
And he'd storm out and say, don't ask me any dumb questions.
Yeah. Well, that's my point. Look at their actions, not their words.
Absolutely.
Insurance is up. They're locking all their doors and they have plenty of armed security around them. Why? Because crime is up and they know it better than we know it.
Absolutely. And then they're angering their constituents by continuing to lie to them.
Well, it just sickens me. So our next topic today, we want to speak about it. We're excited about this. As our longtime listeners know, and I confess I have not been as diligent as I should have been. But
Clark Allers. We're in this together.
But Serge and I had what we think was a very good idea called the Columbia Project, which was an idea addressing mass casualty events in the United States.
Intentional mass casualty events.
That's very important.
Yes.
The idea was, in short, the nutshell version is, just as the United States had a Manhattan Project to develop the atom bomb, where the best and the brightest scientists were organized by government into a cohesive force with one objective, we think that a government and or private sector ought to be organizing the best and the brightest in a number of fields to come together to address mass casualty events. We called it, it was our idea, we called it the Columbia Project. We put it together, we gave it some publicity, we did some work on it, and we got basically nowhere. So, we now have a shot in the arm. And Serge, why don't you tell what the shot in the arm is called?
Well, we have enlisted the help of three very intelligent young ladies from Baltimore City's own Mercy High School. And they are bringing new, refreshing perspectives and ideas, as well as their assistance, to this project.
So Serge said we're going to call them the Mercy Three. Is that correct?
Indeed.
The Mercy Three. And these young women, we're not using their names at this point for a couple of reasons, including, frankly, in this day and age and on this project, security. But we've met with these young women. They've had great input so far. They've agreed to work with us. And I just want to point this out for our listeners because, to me, talk about putting your money where your mouth is. All three of these young women have already completed their community service hours for high school. So this is 100% a volunteer effort on their part. They get nothing except the satisfaction of doing something, trying something for their community. their future voters, presumably their future, they're going to have families of their own someday. And after our first meeting, I turned to Serge and I said, you know, Serge, there are people that you know they're intelligent from their physical affect. When you look at them, you see it in their eye. There's a brightness.
Yes.
To some people in their eyes and their mannerisms and the way they express themselves. And I got to tell you, these were three impressive young women, and we welcome them to the project. In fact, they outnumber us. It's the Mercy Three but Serge and Clark are just two-fifths of this effort now.
And one thing that I think is important is that they agree that we are all tired of the government just throwing money at problems and us getting or seeing very few results, and that it's high time that with a subject like this, that the government start throwing intellectual power rather than just money at the problem, trying to solve it.
I concur. I think as they were here, they talked about their high school, Mercy High School, with pride. And I noted that the highest per capita commitment to public school students in Maryland is the Baltimore City public school system, where, as we know,
financial commitment.
Yes, financial commitment, which we know in 2023 netted entire high schools that didn't have a single student to pass the math proficiency.
For that grade level, which is
now,
just.
Now, I'm 100% convinced, Serge, that if you could corral 100 people in a subway car in any city in America, or take 100 seats in a stadium, or find 100 people that walk in or out of a fast food restaurant, that you'd have at least one who could pass the high school math proficiency today, anywhere in America at any time.
I agree.
Except
Baltimore.
A high school in Baltimore City where they're taught, where we're spending a lot of money per student to be taught this, and you can't even find one student proficient enough. To me, it's shocking.
It's sickening, Clark.
It is sickening. And I don't know why this doesn't happen, but we talk about the difference between bureaucracy and meritocracy. And one of my pet peeves in this day and age is DEI. And I always say, if I was a politician, I would say, this is where DEI goes to DIE, because it wouldn't get past me if I were an elected politician somewhere, if I could prevent it.
Well, I'm going to say this, though, Clark. I personally agree with the sentiment, just like I agree with the Black Lives Matter sentiment. But in practical application, I don't even know what I'm witnessing.
Well, first of all, I think we are diverse, and I think we are inclusive. My point is, as a culture, I think we've made great strides in America to be that. And the point I was going to make is this. Mayor Scott is all DEI. He's all about diversity, equity, inclusivity in his city. So I would say the following. The majority of your students are African-American in your high school.
This is true.
Fire whoever got the most amount of money to teach them.
And that's what I mean by practical application, because we're not experiencing.
Right. But I'm saying, in other words, if you want diversity, equity, and inclusivity to work, then it's got to work with the following: reading fundamentals and math fundamentals.
Absolutely.
Has to.
The kids have to be equipped.
Correct. If it doesn't, fire the people.
Yes.
And don't tell me that you've met your DEI goals in every high school in Baltimore and you haven't met your math proficiency scores. In other words, I'm sick of it. It's ridiculous.
The kids have no opportunity, but you want to tell me that DEI is your goal. I don't buy it.
You know, I say this, I say this to be intentionally provocative, and if Mayor Brandon ever heard this, I hope he would be provoked. Do you know what the Baltimore City public schools equip their students to be?
What's that?
Criminals in Baltimore City.
And it's sad to hear that, but that's what's being demonstrated. And for people not to be angrier about this, it just blows my mind.
Serge, I can't get any angrier without the, you know, FBI serving a search warrant on me. Because seriously, I'm sickened by it. And I don't act on this, but I do believe that when government is this inefficient, it is our duty as citizens to resist that government.
Well, like I think I've often said, Clark, it gets to a point where I think they're being purposely inefficient. And that's why
I don't believe this can happen.
I think they are just cogs in this system that we've often many people consider systemically racist. So I'd have to see proof otherwise. All the words and the DEI talk is just that talk.
A thought just occurred to me. I'm going to spit it out. Maybe I'll edit it out.
Just spit it out.
If I don't edit this out, you'll know it's a provocative thought. But I wonder if you went back to 1950 Baltimore City Public Schools, and I wonder if there were primarily white teachers and white Board of Education superintendent, mm-hmm. probably a white Board of Education. And I wonder what percentage of African Americans in that presumptively racist system were math proficient. And if it's a higher number, then the answer is not DEI.
And reading proficient.
Correct. And I find myself saying, I'm not for a second, don't want to be misunderstood, I'm not suggesting it's morally appropriate, legally appropriate, or any other type appropriate to be racist. What I'm saying is something's wrong if the racist system produced better results than the current DEI system.
The proof should be in the pudding, Clark Eilers, and it clearly is not.
Well, those are our thoughts for today. God rest the soul of Jonathan Diller. May he rest in peace. There has been a fundraising effort on behalf of his spouse to help her and her family. You can obviously go online and contribute to that, and we thank you if you did. Serge and I participate every month with Tunnels to Towers, which provides homes for example, they'll pay off the mortgage for Jonathan Diller's widow. We're very proud of that. And we hope that the Mercy 3 will help put our idea in the eye of the public, and it'll be given some consideration. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
But life is never easy. There's work to be done and obligations to be met. Obligations to truth, to justice, and to liberty.
This podcast is the copyrighted property of Black and White and Thin Blue Lines Incorporated, a Maryland corporation. Any rebroadcast of the podcast without the written permission of the owner is prohibited. For more information, we invite you to visit the website blackandwhiteandthinbluelines.com. All of the words in the URL address use common spelling and are typed together with no spaces. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast, and we welcome your remarks through email. The email addresses of the co-creators, Serge Antonin and Clark Eilers, may be found on the website.